Okay, hello there, everyone, and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Tim Phillips.
Tim, the survivor of the great 2024 spring ahead.
Yeah, barely. Didn't know what time it was. Glad I got on this on time here.
Kind of odd that they're doing the Oscars on the same day as Daylight Savings. That seems like a real faux pas, like stylists in Hollywood have lost an hour of prep time.
Yeah. And isn't it earlier this year, or maybe it
is? Yeah, it's at 7. It's at 7. Yeah. No, it usually starts at 8. Well, that's Eastern time, too, because that means that they're starting at 4 or on the West. Again, you know, your hairstylist, your seamstress or tailor or like whatever the army is that gets you the star prepped for the Oscars has lost an hour of valuable prep time.
They have, yeah, and it's all happening middle of the afternoon, so
yeah,
won't be fun like Golden Globes. People won't be drinking as much.
They don't serve dinner there either.
Dinner.
You know, that's just like just to start at, you know, the early bird dinner time, which is 4. It's a disaster already.
They have it tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. All they get are those $200,000 gift bags, right? That's
oh,
it.
The worst. The worst.
Yeah.
if it isn't a $250,000 gift bag, I'm out. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We're here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new character drama, Perfect Days, which you can now stream on VOD. And if you want to see it on the big screen, I believe The Bookshelf is running it next week.
Nice.
So I'll double check that as we get into the show. But in the first half, Tim's really hitting these anniversaries hard.
Yeah, you sent me a list. Now it's gonna be anniversaries every time I'm on.
Okay. But a couple of weeks ago, it was the 40th anniversary of the release of This Is Spinal Tap. Yeah. I can't speak for Tim, but I know my first contact with Spinal Tap was actually an episode of The Simpsons.
Oh yeah,
do you remember that?
I remember that episode. Wasn't Otto driving?
He was
concert or something.
Yes, yeah. It's called The Otto Show, and I actually looked it up. It's episode 22 of season 3, so it's like really early on in the Simpsons run. So that of course, Harry Shearer, who plays one of the members of Spinal Tap in This Is Spinal Tap, is voice of about half dozen other characters on the show. And did I say half dozen? Because I meant half a dozen. That doesn't even make sense. But
it's a big number.
It's a big number.
There's a lot of voices number. On.
It's a big number. That's what happens when you're looking stuff up while you're while you're talking. But yeah, so that's how I got started, or how I became aware of Spinal Tap. I probably didn't watch it for another couple of years after that because I thought Spinal Tap was made up for The Simpsons. But this is
how I got started with them is, yeah. It's funny, I was reading some of these reviews at the time where some people are like, wow, I barely knew that was a parody.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't, because they play it so straight.
Yeah.
And actually, first time I became aware of Spinal Tap, I thought they were a legit hard rock band.
You're not alone.
Because in 1992, they put a Break Like the Wind album out.
Yeah.
And I was only 13 years old. And like, I was listening to Aerosmith and Guns N' Roses and bands like that. And they came up with this video called Bitch School,
yep.
Which is like one of the most offensive videos you'll ever see. But it had heavy rotation on Much Music.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, this is just like your average hard rock band, juvenile, like Aerosmith and Guns N' Roses.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they were like a real band.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I liked music like that. So I bought that CD. And I looked on their Wikipedia page. That album went to number 44 in Canada.
It sure did.
And I can guarantee you a lot of people weren't in on the joke who bought that album. And no, I was one of them. And then I saw them get interviewed on, I think it was Arsenio Hall show. And then I was like, oh, this is just one big joke. I didn't realize till then. I thought this was like a band like Judas Priest or Aerosmith or you name the band, Motley Crue. I thought it was that type of band.
Yeah. It's funny because one of the top results on Google is still is Spinal Tap a real band? Like when you search Spinal Tap and it gives you like a list of like frequently asked questions, like the top five asked questions in regard to this search, and the top one is like, is Spinal Tap a real band?
Yeah,
it's crazy. But I mean, that was also like the early 90s. Like, speaking of the Simpsons again, like the Simpsons put out an album. Like, the Simpsons were so insanely popular, they were putting out like Simpsons albums. And
and they play their instruments for real. Like,
That's it. It's like the attention to detail, right?
Yeah. Like, Christopher Guest is a really good guitarist, and apparently he played on like a Michael McKean album early on that was like a Laverne and Shirley,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, like Squiggy and whatever their names were album.
Lenny and Squiggy.
Lenny and Squiggy, and he was in the liner notes as Nigel Tufnel, which became his Spinal Tap name. And apparently they did sketches like in like 78 where they were Spinal Tap. So they were well honed before this film came out in 84 with their shtick and with their songs and their stage mannerisms and all that. So,
They worked together, Harry Shearer and Rob Reiner, on a TV pilot for a sketch show called The TV Show. And in that pilot, there was a Spinal Tap. And then McKeon and Guest were a part of that. And I guess they had such a great time doing it that they decided to make this Spinal Tap movie. And Reiner, Guest, McKeon, and Shearer got together, started writing it, and they realized they could not script a movie like they wanted to make, or like something to that effect, which is one of those things like, oh, we were so into the process that we realized we couldn't script the movie we wanted, which is like one of those, it's one of those Hollywoodisms. But like the extreme dedication to the gag is what sells it. And not only that, but like there's real filmmaking craft. Like, I can't remember if this was Rob Reiner's first film or if it's his second film.
It was his first film.
Was it his first film?
Yeah.
Oh shoot, it was. Yeah, no, but what's funny is that like his dedication to like play, like just leaning into the traps and the archetypes of the documentary, and it just feels like a real documentary, which adds like there's real authenticity to it, which let's do this whole thing. Like, is Spinal Tap real? Because this seems very, very real. And they're carrying on like whole conversations. They're just like loony. And nobody's breaking character.
No.
It's just so remarkable. It's like interviewing people in a bathtub, and it's just normal. They're talking about how one of the Spinal Tap drummers like blew up on stage, and he's just explaining it so matter of factly. I don't know if this should be studied in like spy courses. Like they should get those three guys like to teach like CIA assets, like how to spy, how to create your own reality. I mean, heck, they might have. I don't know.
Yeah, and it's like you said, it's all improvised, and yeah, it's a forerunner for so many, like you think of the Office TV shows and Curb Your Enthusiasm, which are completely improvised. And I think to varying effects, and they're all those shows are highly lauded shows. But this, I do like how straight they play it and how it is improvised, because my favorite line probably in the whole film is the two-word review for shark sandwich.
Yeah.
Which I think Rob Reiner must have come up with it, because he delivers that line, I'm pretty sure. And the band, they just they do start to break a bit. They start to laugh. It's just like, what? And then they roll out, and they're like, they didn't write that. Let me see that article.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like so funny. And of course, there's so many lines that are, you know, in the lexicon now, like "Hello Cleveland" when they're lost backstage, and "Up to 11" on the amplifier.
Yeah,
it goes one more. It's louder. It doesn't go to 10. It goes to 11.
Yeah,
and it's just so spot on. And I like how they show the different phases of Spinal Tap, where they go from like a skiffle band, to like a flower power band.
Yeah.
And they have that song, Listen to the Flower People.
Yeah.
Which is a real earworm for me. I sometimes just sing that, like, out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Like, if I tell somebody, listen, and like, I'll be like, listen, then I'll hear, like, the song in my head. So they wrote some great songs, too, right? Like, in that sort of Weird Al school, but they're not going straight off of a hit song. They're just, they know the genres. They've obviously listened to a lot of the psychedelic bands and heavy metal bands, and they know that world, and they get so immersed in it. It's really brilliant in that respect. And I think there've been a lot of mockumentaries based on this, but I still don't know if any have really achieved what this one achieved. So many great scenes, like the scene with the Stonehenge.
Yeah, yeah. <You know? laughs> And the 18 inches, yeah. It's
we have to do something. We have to do something big, something different with our stage show. And then he draws up the dimensions, and he puts inches instead of feet. And it shows you, like, with these bands, how they have so many yes people around them that nobody would even question this. And they're like, okay, yeah, we'll do up the Stonehenge, the miniature Stonehenge.
Well, I mean, the yes man quality of it, like every idea they have is just like pure gold, even if it's like completely ludicrous, like the Stonehenge, and then having, little people dance around it, I guess, to make it look taller. I don't know. Yeah. It is the detail of it is what sells it. Because like those reviews that Reiner's reading that you mentioned, like, those do, speaking as a former reform music critic myself, you definitely try and like be literate and clever in your little like two word takedown of some of these these albums. Like things like Shark Sandwich, that sounds like it's so purposely provocative, and like the album art, it does look like an Aerosmith cover from the early 80s.
This is a top to what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see, the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, 11,
and most of
11,
these and amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes, be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up, all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is, if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Yeah, they just know all the fact, like all these people, like Jimi Hendrix died, he choked on his own vomit.
Mm-hmm.
I think the same thing happened to Janis Joplin. And then they take it and they said he choked on vomit.
Mm-hmm.
But it was someone else's vomit.
Yeah.
they're not sure whose vomit it is. You can't really dust for vomit or whatever. It's just like they know all the details, right?
The whole thing with the drummers, like it's like a really dark joke. Because Grateful Dead, like, I think they had 8 keyboardists and 6 of them died.
Yeah.
So like that's a little close to the surface This whole idea that, if you're a drummer, you're doomed, because I'm sure there are like some keyboardists from Grateful Dead who, felt a little like the red shirt too. So, I mean, it's not just that it's like randomly funny. There's like kind of some dark gallows humor.
Yeah, I think drummers often considered like the more disposable
member
of the band historically, right? And I
look
think,
at Ringo,
Ringo's
the butt of every joke.
And Ringo was the replacement of another Pete Best who didn't cut it,
That's right.
Nirvana's drummer didn't cut it. Dave Grohl came in. So it was
Dave Grohl doesn't play drums anymore, though, unless he's
because he's advanced beyond that, right? Kind of thing. So, hate to say that for all the great drummers listening, but I think it's considered like a disposable thing somewhat, right? And there have been and a lot of people like Pearl Jam, I think, said they've gone through 5-6 drummers, and they say that, so they're very Spinal Tap.
Mm-hmm.
So Spinal Tap's part of the lexicon now. It's like, our band is very Spinal Tap, or this very Spinal Tap thing happened.
Yeah, there's an actual quote from one of the band members of the Misfits, who said that his band was Spinal Tap, or his band before the Misfits. I can't find it now, but I'm also like, when I saw Anvil, the documentary about that, the Canadian hard rock band Anvil, like that had a very Spinal Tap quality, and there were a lot of people. I think I remember this correctly. There were a lot of people that at times like, was Anvil real? Like, is this the Canadian Spinal Tap? And it turned out Anvil was real.
Mm-hmm.
But people were able to sort of like read the code, as it were, because Anvil had this very kind of like Spinal Tap quality, this sort of grandiosity. It's like, we're capital R rock and rollers, and we're performers, and the big hair. And I mean, because they weren't like huge. They weren't Led Zeppelin huge, they were still trying, and they were still doing like these small shows on the weekend, although they had all kind of gone on with their lives.
Yeah.
But there's definitely a feeling watching that. There's definitely a Spinal Tap feeling, because of course, what happens to Spinal Tap over the course of the show? It begins with all this pomposity and like, yeah, we're rock gods. And then as the tour drags on, they're playing smaller venues, and they're playing like bowling alleys and
military bases.
And yeah, what was that? Like a sock hop at like a military base?
I think so. And that's actually based, there were bands who played military bases, apparently, like, once their popularity waned in like the 60s, 70s, military bases were big for hard rock bands and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, it's, I mean, there's definitely, you see the trajectory of a band like in the space of 90 minutes. What I find interesting is that there's apparently like a 270 minute cut of this film, like a working cut. And I that's like three times, it's almost literally three times as long as the actual finished film, which kind of flabbergasts me, because I mean, I love this movie, it does feel like it comes like this close to overstaying its welcome. Like the gag almost goes on a little too long. By the time a guest comes back in the end he returns to the band and is like, oh yeah, by the way, we're huge. Like, they spend the last 5 minutes talking about how this is the end of the band, and then guest comes back, it's like, oh, by the way, we're huge in Japan, so now guess where we're going now. But that, like, there's a definite like, okay, I get it, they're, you know, when he's at the airport going through the metal detector, and he takes the cucumber wrapped in foil out of his pants, like, I get it. The joke has been sold. Every part of the joke has been cut up and spoken for. So, but it is interesting to think that there's like a 3 hour, not even 3 hour, like, what is that, four and a half hour version of this out there somewhere?
Well, apparently they filmed over 100 hours. And it took 3 editors to put it together.
Believe
but
it.
I agree with you. It's like the pretty much the perfect length, I would say.
Yeah.
You don't want something like that to be like 2.5 hours. It'd be interesting to watch, but I wouldn't want.
Yeah, it's
to
an
release
interesting
something like that.
It's an interesting artifact, but I wouldn't pop it in. I mean, in so much as you pop in a 4.5 hour movie.
Yeah.
Um.
Yeah. There's an interesting factoid though that I saw on the Wikipedia page, you know, where they're lost backstage, and they're yelling, and bass player keeps yelling, "Hello, Cleveland." That's based on Tom Petty got lost in a venue in Germany, walking through a series of doors backstage, and he ended up on an indoor tennis court instead of the instead of the venue. So like so much of this was like based on real stuff. So that's kind of funny. A documentary based on like what real events this was based on. I'd watch that. Maybe like a short documentary, like 45 minutes, hour on like what were the inspirations for this? I think that'd be pretty fun.
That would be
Yeah.
interesting. Can we talk a bit about like some of the cameos in this?
Oh yeah.
Like Billy Crystal,
As
and
a
vaguely
mime,
as
right?
a mime waiter.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's another like weird little detail. It's like they're having this party and the waiters are mimes.
I think miming was really big because there's a lot of stand-up comics in the 80s who rip on mimes. So in Los Angeles, there must have been a lot of mimes
There
walking
was a
around.
mime. There was a mime movement.
Yeah. Because that's the one line that makes me cringe a bit is when he says mime is money. I'm just like, ew, that's just,
No, I love
yeah,
it. I
maybe
love
you like that, but that's
it.
making me cringe, that one.
That's the
Yeah.
perfect improvised line. It's pun gold. Yeah, that'd be an interesting documentary. It's like, was there some sort of mime movement in the 80s? Fred Willard as the Air Force captain who welcomes him to the Air Force base.
Yeah.
Howard Hessman was in one scene.
Fran Drescher
Fran
as.
Drescher, oh my God. I completely forgot she was in this, and she was like, she's so good as their literally Bobby Flackman as their flack.
Well, yeah, the cover of their album, Smell the Glove, is like, she's like, this is totally sexist. And they're like, oh, it's meant to be sexy. We wanted to
Yeah,
make a sexy
that's
cover.
right. And yeah, she's like trying to talk them down, and then yeah, they get the call that they can't sell it in Sears and Kmart. Two brands that really made the went the distance in the 21st century too.
Yeah.
I don't even think Kmart made it to the 21st century. I think Kmart was done in Canada before the turn of the century, if I remember correctly, because
Could be.
the Stone Road Mall Zellers was a Kmart at one point.
Yeah. Yeah, Kmart used to be huge. I
Yeah.
think you might still see them at least like 10 years ago. I was in the States and I saw a Kmart. So they probably just have a few ones here and there.
Yeah, the ghost Kmart's like the ghost Blockbusters, or that one Zellers off the Gardner, wherever that is.
Yeah, but that was a big thing if you couldn't get into Kmart, right? So I
Well, yeah, the
remember that even
Kmart,
in the
yeah.
90s, if your album didn't get into Kmart, so you'd have to like clean up the cover art and stuff to get into
Well,
Kmart.
that was the famous Nirvana controversy on their second album. That's how you get Waif Me instead of Rape Me.
Oh yeah, wow.
So
Yeah.
it's yeah, no, that I mean that was a real thing. It's kind of odd to think about now. I mean, that this is like the prime time of like Madonna and all the like Frank Zappa, who like actually they actually called to Congress to testify about obscenity in rock and roll.
Oh yeah, and Dee Snider from Twisted Sister.
Dee
Weird,
Snider,
weird times.
yeah. Oh, they're so weird. Remember Tipper Gore?
Yeah,
but
Aerosmith has a song where they reference her, where they're like, "Tipper's okay" or something. It's just
Tipper's
like, what is wrong? But
Oh my goodness.
yeah. And but like they did, yeah, in the movie they make it turn it into like a black album, right? They just take all the cover art off. There's no,
Yeah,
they
and
don't
they're
even say the band name.
yeah, and then it backfires when the sales falter. And it's at first it's like this brilliant notion, and then when it doesn't work, and then everyone's talking about how stupid it was, and we can't believe that somebody foisted that upon them, and they foisted it upon themselves. I mean, that's the nature of these creative outlets. Is I mean, it, and it's interesting talking about it. It's interesting just throwing stuff at the wall, and we joke about the Stonehenge and It's just it's fascinating to look back at a time when you didn't know what would stick, and to watch them evolve in those flashbacks you mentioned, like going from like Beatles-esque, where they're in the nice suits, just standing there tapping their toes, strumming the guitar, to like the flower power, to the hair metal. You really can't sort of get away with that kind of like freewheeling creative evolution anymore. And I don't want to be like, oh, the past was better, but you know, it really does feel like you get pigeonholed as one thing. And as soon as you don't want to serve that one thing anymore, the culture moves on to the next thing we can pigeonhole. There are
Yeah.
very few artists who can sort of get away with that. Taylor Swift being a mom, she was a country star, now she's a pop star, now she's kind of like even like a global creative star, like with directing her own videos, you know, producing her own shows, you know, making her own movie deals.
Yeah.
It's that kind of creative evolution is almost harder now. So this is kind of an ode to, I don't know, choosing your own destiny as much as it is to like the pomposity and self-importance of rock and roll. There may actually be something to aspire to in Spinal Tap rather than just laugh at, which
Yeah.
I find kind of interesting too, given
Yeah.
where we are in the culture now.
Yeah. They're trying to evolve, but they're probably devolving. They're trying to evolve,
Well,
right? They
this is
actually have
it.
some nice sort of Beatles-esque ditties, and then they become popular for Sex Farm in Japan, right? So they're kind of de-evolving, I guess, but they're trying, yeah, they're
But
trying.
you
And
know, there's this one of the things they're talking about, they're gonna like do when they're retired. I can't remember which one like raises this musical about Jack the Ripper, but I mean, you know,
Saucy
that
Jack.
saucy Jack. Yeah, no, you know, it has this kind of like the Dracula puppet musical vibes of like Forgetting Sarah Marshall. I guess probably that was inspired by, you know, Saucy Jack, but just, you know, this sort of like creative liberation of, you know, you kind of had your time and now you can sort of pursue these pet projects that maybe not everyone's going to love and you're not worried so much about selling things. But of course, what is Rob Reiner doing right now? He's talking about Spinal Tap 2.
Oh, is he? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was apparently supposed to start shooting last month, but I haven't found anything like updated about it. They're talking about this, I think since 22, doing some sort of reunion. The plot of it is apparently their manager dies, and Tony Hendra, who plays her manager in the movies, he passed away in real life a couple of years ago. But their manager passes away. His heir finds the Spinal Tap contract and discovers that they apparently owe one more concert to fulfill the obligation of their contract. So they get back together, do one last concert, and apparently there's going to be cameos from Elton John and Garth Brooks and Paul McCartney, which, I mean, I understand why you'd want to have like big celebrities in a Spinal Tap
Yeah.
sequel, but the fact that, you know, I mean, you have famous people in Spinal Tap, but they're not playing themselves. It just seems like the ultimate expression. It's like we had this thing 40 years ago that was turned out to be, I mean, it wasn't necessarily successful at the time, but in the intervening years, it's been extremely successful. And now we are going to staple as many famous people as we can to it. It's like the ultimate expression of where Rob Reiner is as a director right now. This like kind of the lamentation of the nostalgia boomer. Weren't things better back when?
Yeah.
Which kind of, I mean, I don't want to prejudge. I mean, they could make it. It could be like the Top Gun Maverick of rock and roll mockumentaries, but the face of it just seems so desperate and bad.
Yeah.
It seems like
It'd
a
be almost better if they didn't make it, right? And like they're still trying or something, right? But the moment you have
That's
like Paul
interesting.
McCartney in it, it's like,
Yeah.
okay, they've made it somehow, or you know.
That's what would take it up to 11, though, is if they made a mockumentary about trying to make a Spinal Tap sequel. that would
get really meta with it.
That would take it up to 11, as it were.
Yeah. get creative with it. Yeah, just like a parade of celebrity cameos as themselves doesn't really appeal to me. But
yeah,
they're so funny, they'll probably make it work somehow. But it'd be better if they were, I think, if they're still struggling or something, you know, like they're, you know, in their 60s now and they're still trying to make it, you know.
It's interesting because, like, the on the one hand, the music business itself is so different, but on the other hand, so much of the music business now is so insular. It's like it's on your phone, it's on your laptop, it's not necessarily in the stadiums unless you reach a Taylor Swift like plateau. It's in college bars. It's on Spotify, and I'm not sure that's what Spinal Tap can be attenuated to. But again, I reserve final judgment when and if this movie ever comes out.
Or Spinal Judgment.
Spinal That's the mime is money of
mime
this episode.
Is money.
Yeah. That's good. Leave them wanting more. That's where we'll leave it for our Spinal Tap discussion. We're going to come right back with something completely different, though. A review of Perfect Days. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And then okay, that was a clip from Perfect Days. It is the new film from writer and director Wim Wenders, and it stars, and may everyone of a Japanese persuasion forgive my pronunciation, Koji Yakusho, Tokyo Imoto, Arisa Nakano, Ayo Yamamata, Yumi Aso, Sayuri Ishikawa, and Tomokazu Miura. I think
that sounded right to me, Adam.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Well, yeah. noted Japanese language scholar Tim Phillips says that's okay.
Right.
Okay. So, Perfect Days, from Wim Wenders, who is an incredibly talented filmmaker, who I'm very sad to say is kind of one of my blind spots. I've seen the big ones. I've seen Paris, Texas, and Wings of Desire, but I haven't taken in the whole filmography. He is a very accomplished filmmaker, has been in business for years and years and years. Perfect Days is one of the recording this before the Oscars, so it could be an Oscar winner, but it is an Oscar nominee this year for Best International Film. It is Japan's entry. It was a Japanese-German co-production. And it follows a man named Hirayama as he goes about his life, waking up in the morning, going through his routine, going to work where he cleans public toilets around Tokyo, and then goes and watches some baseball, has a beer.
Listens to a lot of music.
Listens to tapes, reads some books, goes to the used bookstore. Just living his best life, which is what this seems to be. Like, Perfect Days is kind of it's not just the title of the film, it's kind of the state of mind. But Tim, what did you think of Perfect Days?
I really liked it. I thought his daily ritual, it's engrossing and it's not boring, right? Like, something, if you describe this, okay, it's a toilet cleaner. He gets up every day at dawn. He gets in his truck. He goes.
No alarm clock either. I noticed that.
Yeah. So he know he's so in tune to everything. He gets up at dawn. He gets like, it looks like an iced coffee from a vending machine that's like right outside his where he lives, because there's mm-hmm. vending machines everywhere in Tokyo.
Yep.
And then he goes and he cleans these public toilets, eats a sandwich in the park, takes pictures of the trees, goes to the same place for dinner every night, goes on the weekends, goes to a used bookstore. It's just like this everyday living,
mm-hmm.
but it's so well done that I was engrossed by it. And it reminded me of Jim Jarmusch's Patterson from 2016,
mm-hmm.
where Adam Driver plays a bus driver who just does a daily routine, and he writes poetry when he has spare time. He finds time to write poetry. And I watched Perfect Days with my wife, and I said, oh, it's just like Patterson, except he's not really pursuing any sort of, he doesn't have any artistic pursuits. And she corrected me. He's like, no, he does the photography in the park every day.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's very similar to that. And I love the movie Patterson. And this one I really liked as well. And Wim Wenders, I may have seen a few more films than you have, but you've seen the top two for me, which is Paris, Texas and Wings of Desire.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, not quite at that level, but it is an excellent film. And it just shows, you know, the sort of the moral of it is that you can be happy, even if, you know, society tells you like being a toilet cleaner is like low on the rung,
yeah,
you know, of respected employment. You can be happy doing that as long as you're happy with yourself. You know, you're in touch with your own emotions, because he's not happy the whole movie. He has sad moments, but he's in tune with it.
Yeah.
And he's just sort of living his best life doing what he enjoys doing. He takes pride in his work as a toilet yeah. cleaner. And I would say this shows some maturity from Wim Wenders as well, because when I knew it was about a toilet cleaner, I was concerned that there would be some gross scenes. You know, like, is there, what are these toilets going to be like?
Because
mm-hmm. there is a Wim Wenders movie that he directed called Kings of the Road, where he films a lead character dropping a deuce on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that in this there isn't anything gross in the toilets, and actually it makes me want to use the toilets in Japan, and just
they're beautiful, yeah,
beautiful architecture. It says a lot. And actually doing the research, I found out that I think the Japanese government approached Jim Jarmusch because they had done this revitalization on their public toilets and wanted him to do short films or documentaries about it. And he got so interested in it that he's created a feature film. Wim Wenders. Oh, I said Jim Jarmusch.
You said Jarmusch, but Wim Wenders, yeah.
He's created this feature film because he was so excited by it. But I think it's really cool. And his use of music, very eclectic.
Yeah.
And that's a Wim Wenders thing. Like in a lot of his movies, he has a real mix of sort of popular music and then music that's sort of popular to him, where he doesn't really distinguish between, you know, what the popular music is and what the less popular. So there's a song that's repeated in this, Redondo Beach by Patti Smith, which is a pretty dark song about suicide on a beach in California, which is repeated throughout. He mentions Lou Reed, which is, you know, a lot of people know who Lou Reed is, but he's still more of a cult artist.
Yeah.
But then the lead character, he listens to Brown Eyed Girl by Van Morrison. He listens to Dock of the Bay by Otis Redding.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this real mishmash of the eclectic music that Wim Wenders likes. So he's really put himself into this film in a lot of ways, which I like as well, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it is, you know, a Japanese-German co-production, right? There's like this eclectic thing. And I think the Japanese culture and the German culture are fascinated by American culture. So the fact that we're hearing Otis Redding and we're also hearing Lou Reed and we're also hearing Patti Smith shows that fascination. which I think is really cool. And but yeah, I think it's like, you know, the moral is, you know, enjoy what you do, find enjoyment. And, you know, the character, when his sister comes to pick up his niece who had dropped by, disrespects him, like, I can't believe you're a toilet cleaner. And you can see he feels bad and he sort of cries a bit, but it's like,
I love that the acting in that scene,
yeah,
where she shows up, she has a driver, and I think it's implied that their family comes from money.
Mm-hmm.
Because she also mentions, like, you should go see our father. And she mentions to him he's different now, which makes me wonder, like, was there some kind of schism that made Hirayama sort of like move out and go on his own and start his own sort of personal journey outside of whatever, like, family business. But to get back to what you're talking about, when she asks him, she says, like, I hear you're cleaning toilets, and he nods his head like, yes. Like, and it's this kind of furtive move where he's like, he knows what her reaction is going to be, but I mean, it's what he does. And he, as you said, he puts a lot of pride and care and energy into making these toilets as clean as they can be. But then it shows her, the reaction on her face. And she has this just abject look of horror on her face. Like, he had just said that he cleans toilets with blood or something. It's just, she cannot believe, like, he might as well have said, like, he kills people in the park. It's, yeah. it's a roughly equivalent, like.
Yeah. And she's like, I can't believe you do this. And then she has the chauffeur for the driver. And so it's implied they come from wealth.
Yeah.
But there's so little dialogue in this, right? That you don't really learn a lot through the dialogue. It's just sort of, you can piece things together.
It's interesting because I've seen, like, some criticisms, like, you don't learn a lot about Hirayama. And I'm like, actually, you learn a lot about Hirayama. Like, you don't learn, like, specifics. But there are, like, things that happen that, like, the kid he's working with through most of the film, like, quits on the phone, like, kind of calls him and, like, yeah, I quit, bye, thanks for everything, and hangs up. Like, there's a real fear that this kid has, although he's, like, constantly telling, like, this is my senior, which sounds like kind of a put down, but it's, but, like, in the scene in the tape store, where he goes into the tape store and he's like, we could sell your tapes and, like, we'll have a bunch of cash. Yeah. And Hirayama's like, you know, he's curious. He's looking around. He's curious. And he's like, no, I don't want to sell my tapes. It's because he has, like, a huge tape collection at home. So he's, like, clearly put a lot of care. Like, everything is, like, a lot of care, effort, and energy. He's just, like, curating this library of tapes that he has. And the kid grabs the tape and he's like, I'm going to sell this tape so I can have some cash. And Hirayama just looks at him and puts his hand out and, like, moves his finger, like, give it to me. Just give it to me. And the kid relents. Like, he never, like, Hirayama says nothing. He just looks him straight in the eye, puts out his hand. And there's the scene later on after the kid quits. And so Hirayama's, like, cleaning all the toilets on his own. And it's like, he's usually, you see him finishing when it's still light out. So he has, like, some time, you know, to run his errands or whatever. And he's been cleaning toilets all day because he's been doing it himself. And then he gets on his phone and he calls his boss and he's like, you know, this is the third time I've gotten the message or I've gotten the voicemail. Like, this is the only day I'm doing this. You better have someone cleaning toilets with me tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And he hangs up. And then somebody's there, like, right the next day.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not sure if that's, like, Japanese work ethic or what that's supposed to be, but I read it as, you do not want to mess with Hiri.
No, you don't want to mess. And they respect his work probably so much, right? To do that type of job and be, who knows, I don't know if it ever says how long he's been doing it, but let's say he's been doing it 10 years, 20 years, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's going to be high turnover in a job like that, like with his younger colleagues. So they respect him. And that's a turning point for me in the film. Like, he really stands up for himself, shows some backbone. Because earlier on with his younger colleague, it's him being nice as well. So it's not necessarily that he doesn't have backbone, but, like, he gives them the money to go on the date.
Yeah.
And it's all the money he has.
Yeah.
And then he runs out of gas, so he has to go back, and it's implied he has to sell one of his tapes to that.
Yeah.
Back at that cassette store just so he can afford gas to get home. He's given all his cash to this young guy to go on a date.
Unsuccessful date, we should have.
And it's so like that point, it's like, okay, he's standing up for himself, and you know, and it shows that his job isn't something that he's forced to do necessarily. It's something he's enjoying doing, you know, and that can blow people's minds that he's a toilet cleaner, but he enjoys doing it, right? You know, in society in general, and I don't know if it's different in Japanese society, but I know in North American society that would be sort of frowned upon, and it's frowned upon by his wealthy sister, which is interesting to see that in the film, because before that I'm like, oh, maybe this is a job that's, you know, that somewhat respected, because he's going about his work every day. Everything's very clean, I must say that.
Yeah. Well, it's not like we ever see him disrespected either. Like the only person who kind of looks down on him is his own sister, and I think that's almost like a caste thing. Like not caste, but like I guess, you know, a privileged thing.
Yeah, and the toilets look great.
Oh, they're
And
great.
the
Yeah, they're lovely.
architecture around them looks amazing. And I guess doing this research, I see that Japan wanted Vim vendors to promote their new toilets. So in a way he's doing that. It's funny that there you don't see any gross bits, but it looks all great. And then he does that tic-tac-toe, right?
The
With
tic-tac-toe, I love that. Yeah.
somebody's put a sheet in in sort of a crack by the mirror there, with an O in it, and then he starts playing the game with them and never meets them, and they just play this game because he cleans the same toilet every day. So they play a game of tic-tac-toe, which is fun, and yeah, you see a lot, see a lot of interesting things through the repetition. You know, he sees the same woman in the park each day, and that's kind of interesting because it's like I was wondering at first, because I almost thought she's looking at him maybe with a little disdain to begin with, because he's, you know, wearing the toilet cleaner outfit, he's looking over at her. But then I think they're both similar, you know, solitary people who are in the park just trying to take in nature, right, during their lunch break.
No, there's so many like little characters around. Like there's the homeless person who like he always sees. Like they have like he has like a wood bundle on his backpack. And, you know, there's the one day they kind of acknowledge each other. They kind of nod at each other, which is kind of funny. What I think is interesting about the film is that it's an ode to routine, but it is not a typical in movies. The movie begins when the routine is busted up, or it's implied that this character does not like the routine and they are waiting for something to come along and break the routine. This is not that movie. This is a movie that says, you know, if you have a routine, that's okay. Not everything in life is about, you know, action constantly. And
And this character likes the routine.
yeah,
So when his niece comes, it disrupts his routine.
but
He
then he
likes
works
having
her
her
into the
there.
routine. The routine is adjusted and she becomes part of the routine. Although I do wonder, there's that scene where I guess it's kind of like the Japanese YMCA, where they're both there and you see him on the payphone, which is why it was weird when he took out a flip phone later. It's like, I guess he has that for work. And so he's very sort of rigid, like, this is my work phone. I'm only going to use it for work stuff. But he calls. I think it's implied that he calls his sister on the phone and tells her like the his niece. Yeah, he has his niece, and you know she wants to come get her because she shows up like later that day, the sister. So I do wonder how much of him was like adapting to the niece because he does also tell her like you can come by anytime, which again seems like kind of like a radical thing to. You know, do when you're like in the routine, like just have your niece randomly pop by.
She's very rebellious, and
Yeah.
She almost sort of insinuates herself into his routine, because at first he doesn't want to take her to work, and then she says, if you don't trust what I'm going to do here, she's pretty much threatened she might mess up his place if he doesn't bring her to work that first day. So,
Yeah. Well, I think that was kind of like a. I don't think she was really gonna like pull all the books off the walls or anything, or smash the carefully cultivated plants. But I mean, yeah, she knows how to game the system. I think that's pretty well implied. Yeah, it is an ode to routine. And then you have like in the last scene, or the last bit of the film, where he sees the woman who owns the bar that he goes to, he kind of has a crush on, and he sees her hugging another guy, and then he immediately goes and buys like some beers and some cigarettes.
Yeah, I was thinking, did he maybe, because he doesn't drink before that. I'm pretty sure he's just drinking water.
I think so,
And I
yeah.
was wondering, like, maybe he's an addict, or he had issues in the past with alcohol,
Yeah,
or
I wondered that too.
yeah.
But it just, it's kind of implied that like he kind of crushes on her. He's probably not thinking about like we could go out on a date, because I mean that would be like crossing the streams. That'd be the break in the routine. But he has a bit of a nutty when he sees her hugging who turns out to be her ex-husband of several years. And then the ex-husband catches up to Hirayama and says like, yeah, like I have cancer, I'm dying. Spoiler alerts. It's not really important to the overall plot, but he says like, take care of her for me, Mama, the woman. She's only ever identified as Mama. And Hirayama's kind of taking it like, why would you say that to me? And it's very clear that he's very kind of sensitive to these sort of eruptions. Even like a positive change, like what if we were to have a romantic relationship with this woman? That seems a bit outside the norm as well. Like positive developments seem to
Pretty
take him
slow
aback.
moving, because I
It's
think they
so
mentioned
slow
that, like,
moving.
that restaurant been open 5 years or something like
Yeah,
that. So
that's right.
yeah, he's been going there and seeing her for like 5 years, but
Yeah.
it took that moment really stuck with him, and he's like, oh no, she's with somebody else, and
Yeah.
yeah,
Like, I wonder
and
if it even occurred to him that, like, maybe she's married, maybe she has a boyfriend, or like, it just like. He has this perfect relationship where he goes in and they have this kind of like he listens to her sing, and she knows what he likes, meal wise. She gives him the water, and it's just perfect. And then like this little bit of upset to the routine is enough to make him go grab some beers.
Yeah, and then that's one of the more action-packed moments in the film, where
Yeah.
they're asking, when you overlap shadows, is it darker? And he's like, chase him and
The
the man
ex-husband,
who's
yeah.
the ex-husband, and yeah, who has cancer, and he's, who says to
Hirayama.
Hiriyama, says to Hiriyama, yeah, she take care of her. And then they just playfully are chasing each other around, playing it with their shadows, and
Shadow
it's like
tag, yeah.
shadow tag, which is interesting. Yeah, it's just this playfulness there at the end. And you can look at that as a larger point in the film. Life is short, and enjoy your time. And maybe Hirayama could do more of that, but at the same time, he enjoys his routine, right? So it's like,
Yeah.
why deny the man his daily happiness, just because it's not what others, including his sister, might think is a normal way to be happy, something like that.
Yeah, it's like a rousing call to like find happiness where you are, and I mean, the title is really apt. These are just like perfect days. It's like nothing really big happens. You're just going to work, riding around, running your errands, and maybe that's all you need. There's a real beautiful simplicity to it, which I enjoyed a lot. It's a very restful film in a certain regard. But yeah, I enjoyed it. We're gonna have to call that a day for this week's show. We hope you liked it. If you want to listen to our show again, you can download it every Friday from our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. We're on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can get us through your favorite app like Apple, Google, TuneIn, and Spotify. Speaking of Spotify, you can find the playlist for much of the music that you hear in End Credits. Just open up Spotify and search for End Credits on CFRU. You can stay connected to us on social media. We're on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, and we're on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will return on Thursday, tomorrow at 5 p.m. for News and Politics and Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. And in the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. Or you can check out my News and Politics site at guelphpolitico.ca. And Tim, where else can people find you on the internet?
On the internet, Flash in the Deadpan on social media, Flashy Tim on Letterboxd. Done a few lists. I could probably do some more stuff in there. It's a lot of fun. A lot of fun seeing all the films they have on there and reviewing them and making your lists. I enjoy making lists.
Make your list, check them twice, and stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. This show, End Credits, will be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for another new episode, and we will see you then.